It's called a Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Let me reflect that it's approximately 18 minutes after 2 on this Thursday afternoon, March 18th. I do thank everyone for their patience. Senator Davis and I were over in Senate Transportation Committee and just got out literally a few minutes ago. So anyway, the record should reflect that we do have a quorum. We have to my far left Senator Bundy and my immediate left, Senator Davis, myself, Senator Pascafan. Both Senator Meyer and Senator Thomas has been excused, but I do believe Senator Thomas will maybe joining us a little bit later. But we do have a quorum for this committee meeting. The purpose of our meeting today is to take up three new bills: Senate Bill 300 relating to ADA loans, Senate Bill 292 relating to pawnbrokers, and Senate Bill 304 relating to the Model Entity Transactions Act. I also intend to bring the committee substitute for Senate Bill 129 relating to residential fire sprinklers before us this afternoon, and if it's the will of the committee to move that bill forward. But to get things rolling, I would welcome Ted Leonard and call him forward to present the merits of Senate Bill 300, which relates to ADA. And certainly both of you are welcome.
Thank you.
And please state your names and affiliation, and then when each of you speak, if you're, you know,
great,
just so that the record is clear who's on first.
Okay. To the chair, I'm Ted Leonard. I'm the executive director of ADA. And
My name is Mark Davis, and I'm also with ADA.
To the chair, we want to thank the committee for giving us the opportunity to speak on S. Bill 300. And what I'd like to do is quickly just give a brief summary and then ask Mark Davis to go over the sections 1 through 3 of the bill. And then we also have Kathy Jeans from the Division of Investments, who would go over sections 4 of the 5 of the bill. And she is with Division of Investments, and they actually operate the Rural Development Incentive Fund. So she has would be our best expert on that. Just quickly, ADA has been working on a strategic plan to improve the effectiveness of our program over the last year. And we believe that this bill takes the first steps in moving us to allow better use of capital for businesses and also help us better invest in projects as we move forward. The first section of the bill is actually dealing with modernizing the way that we actually set our incentive, our interest rates for loans that are actually funded through our own internal funds. Currently, as Mark will go through, they're set by us, in essence, pretending that we're going out to the market and asking what the market would buy a bond for us, from us, and what rate. And we've found out that that has been causing us problems, especially during this tumultuous times in the bond market. For a period of time, which Mark will go through, there was actually no municipal bond market. You practically could not sell a bond, so our rates went up to 9.5% to 10% in little over 6 or 7 months. The second section of the bill is one of the things that Mark is responsible for. He's our economic development officer, and he is looking at whatever type of new economic and tools that ADA can use to help us with helping businesses expand. And this one is an incentive rebate program, which allows the agency for certain loans or investments into areas that are economically distressed or for businesses that would, for example, be startups that would add true new jobs to the economy, a rebate of 100 basis points or 1% of the loan. So, and that would be for a term of 5 years. So in essence, what that's really trying to do is help give businesses that are investing in needs that the state have identified a better cash flow for that 5 years and help them during that startup time. And the third section of the bill is to clarify whether or not ADA can invest in a portion of a project versus having to own the full project. And as Mark will go through, there is sections in our bill on the purpose that states that we can own an interest in a project, but when you go over to the statutes that deal with where our monies are, it says we have to own and operate the project. So we believe that we'd like to clarify that, and we believe that it's important due to the fact as we look at economic development infrastructure in the future that these projects could be in the billions of dollars, which would be past ADA's capacity to own, and that layering of investments or layering of funding, working with partners like a native corporation or an investment bank, would be the best way to move forward with those projects. Plus, it would bring more skin into the game on the private sector and spread the risk out, we believe. And then the fourth and fifth sections deal with our Rural Development Initiative Fund. And when we've been talking to the Division of Investments on how we can better promote that fund, they came up with some suggestions that they believe would make the fund more effective and efficient in the rural areas and in the outlying areas. So that's all I have, Chair. If I could have Mark Davis go over to Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Leonard. Senator Bundy.
If I could, and perhaps Mark will cover it. You mentioned the 1% basically subsidy if it was warranted. What impact would that have on ADA's bottom line, or can you project that?
Through the chair to Senator Bundy, we don't believe that it will have a true effect on the bottom line. One of the reasons is that we are putting a we are partitioning off that risk so that we are doing, is it 5% of our loan portfolio to be used in this program? So the reason why we don't think it'll actually affect our bottom line is that for the most part, ADA makes money when we're loaning money instead of investing our own internal funds. So if we can even increase that, even with the rebate, we believe those interest rates would probably be higher than our long-term investment portfolio.
Yeah. Well, I see it. So you don't have to take any money out of your left pocket, but it's less money that's coming in. It's 1%
right,
less.
Right.
And so I'm just wondering what that impact would be.
Quickly, the cost, if you
ballpark.
Could loan it at the full percentage, 20% right now of our portfolio would be, or 5% would be about 16 million. So 100 basis point of that would be about $150,000 off the top of my head.
Not chump change, but
no.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bundy. Please, Mr. Davis.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Davis, and I am with ADA. Let me quickly go through the first change is to AS 4488-159E, and that's how we set the minimum rate for the commercial finance program, which is known as the loan participation program within ADA. That program works by having banks bring clients into ADA, and ADA participates with the bank. So it's a system by which we are really partners with the banks. That provides a filter for credit evaluation and underwriting. It's been a successful program. We've had about 4,720 jobs created since 2002 and about 2,900 construction jobs. Portfolio now stands at $376 million, and we have $24 million pending in applications. Unfortunately, the minimum rate has become uncompetitive over time because, by statute, it is tied to a bond rate. In fact, ADA has not floated a bond since 1987. To raise money for this program. So what happens under the current statute is we contact Goldman Sachs every month. They calculate what it would cost us to float a bond to fund the program, and that sets a rate. What happened with the markets in beginning in 2008 was there was a collapse, and there still is a collapse, of the municipal bond market. So in mid-2009, Our rate, calculated by Goldman Sachs, floated at 9.64, when the commercial rate for money was 5.48. Even today, checking as of the end of February, our rate is 1.33% over what it would be if we were used a market rate. So what we're doing is we're costing companies that wish to use our loan participation program an extra a point or more than a point for really no benefit. The agency can make money at the market rate. Now, we do make money. We need to make under statute, and we intend to make money. But we're actually charging a little bit too much. The economic benefit of these large construction projects is pretty obvious when we build one. And there's also long-term jobs in a lot of the projects. So what we're proposing is instead of using the bond market, we use a nationally recognized market index. That does two things. First, it ties our minimum rate to the cost of money. Now, I emphasize it's a minimum rate. For purposes of underwriting, we could always have a higher rate. We could also calculate in credit risk in the portfolio, and we do so. So not every loan gets the minimum rate. What we would look at could be the Federal Home Loan Bank of Seattle, which is a well-recognized rate in the Northwest that markets money. We could also look at Treasury bills, the Federal Farm Credit Bank's Funding Corporation Funding Index, which is a mouthful, but that's the other major federal index used in the United States, or LIBOR, or we could use Fannie Mae. So there's a bunch of them we could use. If we use those, they'd also be more transparent. Right now, everyone has to wait every month until we recalculate through Goldman Sachs, and then we publish it. If we use the national index, a customer or a bank wanting to know kind of what our rate's going to be, could just look at an index and figure it out. So that would also help business planning. We also think it protects the dividend by setting a floor for the five-year rate of return on the interest rates, so it actually would protect the agency's economic performance. The second change is a potential rebate on that same loan participation program, and it would be no more than 1% of the interest rate charged going back to the customer through the bank. And we would provide that if it creates jobs, furthers rural development, or meets other economic criteria, which we would set by regulation as set forth in the statute. Our proposals and regulations would probably be development in distressed areas. Those would follow the Recovery Zone Act federal standards, or for startup companies, new technology, or alternative energy. But we've had a cap to protect the authority, because we know that the authority's bond rating is important. It could not exceed 5% of the total loan participation portfolio, and the rebate is only for the first 5 years of the loan. It's designed to help a business start up. After that, they'd float up to the full rate. So it's a pretty limited rebate. But having worked as a private transaction attorney in the state, it's usually those first 5 years that are the tough ones before things cash flow sufficiently.
Mark, could I say something? Also, on this one, just quickly, is that this is a rebate. So I'd like to stress that the businesses who are in this program will have to show us that they did meet the criteria. If the loan was based on creating 50 jobs that every year before we gave them the rebate, they would have to show us the proof of hiring those 50 people or doing the type of projects.
Right, and we did a survey of other and similar entities to ADA, and there's 44 in the United States. Several of them have these kind of programs, and they also have reporting requirements, which we are putting in place through regulation through all our loan participations to ask how many construction jobs were used with this loan program, how many permanent jobs, to get a better feel for the impact on the economy. So the rebate program would work in conjunction with the strategic plan to try to use the loan participation program a little bit aimed at economic development and job creation. Obviously, as we face a recession, your twofold approach is to preserve the jobs you've got and find out legitimate ways to create new jobs. And large-term retail and commercial construction can be useful, and that's what this program is used for. So the final thing would be to change the other side of ADA, which is the Development Finance Program. That's the program in ADA that owns big projects like Red Dog Mine or the Skagway Ore Terminal. Right now, the statute is a little unclear. AS 4488-0805 says we can, quote, acquire an interest in a project as necessary or appropriate. However, 4488010A says that we can incur debt, quote, to own and operate facilities. And then the definition of a facility under 4488909 says a plant or facility. Throughout the years, the interchange between those three has been interpreted that we have to own a discrete portion of a project. So with Red Dog, we own the DeLong Mountain Transportation Corridor. We don't have any other interest in the mine. As we approach more modern financing, is our view that ADA should be able to own an indivisible interest in a project. That would mean that we could invest, say, 20% or 30% into a project, like a hydro project, for example, renewable wind farm, or other projects that meet our criteria. We've been in, for example, negotiations yesterday with the U.S. Department of Energy to qualify under Section 1705 financing, and this bill would let us have more access to federal guaranteed loans. So that would be a benefit. So what it also would let us do is have partners. One thing that's good about having a percentage is you've got somebody else looking at the same project to do the math, to make sure that it works. A consortium of partners usually make it a safer investment. If other people aren't interested, you have to ask yourself, why would you be interested? So this would be a change, but we think it's already consistent with the statute, because one of the statutes already says we can own an interest. It's just a little unclear. So it's a clarification. And so that concludes the ADA portion of the bill.
If I could just ask kind of to make sure the record's clear, you believe that these changes advance the underlying purpose of why ADA as an authority was initially created?
Senator Pahafan, yes, I do. Because first, I think the statutes with regard to the partial interest, it already says we can own an interest in a project as necessary, but then the definition of project is inconsistent. I think the definition shouldn't normally override the statutory purpose, but that's kind of what has happened here. As far as the loan participation program, I think the legislature, when they used the bond rating to float bonds, they envisioned two things. First, we actually would go to the market to raise money for the loan participation program, which we have not done. And secondly, the municipal bond market for the last 30 years was a fairly low rate, so it made sense to tie it to a low rate. What's happened, unfortunately, in our country is the municipal bond market is no longer a competitive rate. So we need to switch it. So in that sense, we're just modernizing the same purpose. And the rebate program, I think, is consistent with the goal to alleviate unemployment and to create economic development, which is in the preamble to our statutes. That is, a rebate program should create more construction jobs and allow for more development.
Okay, and then just is there, in the first three sections that we've addressed, is there any portion of this that materially increases the risk to the overall funds that you have control over, any component of the funds that you believe that we should know of, that there's a material risk there?
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe there is. As Executive Director Leonard testified, we would create essentially a firewall with the rebate program, and it's limited to 5% of the portfolio. It's at our discretion. You don't have to get the rebate. We have to be convinced we want to give you a rebate. And secondly, it only goes for five years of usually a 25-year loan. So 20 years the loan is going to pay at the full rate. So it's a very small portion. However, it can be a useful tool, just enough to get the project going, to make something pencil out when it otherwise wouldn't pencil out. And there's no risk to changing our rate. If we have a lower rate that makes sense as the minimum, we can do more business. Now, we're not forced to use that minimum. That's very important. So we can underwrite for credit risk, and we will do so. This only sets a floor. It doesn't set any maximum.
And I would add to that, by putting in the floor for the minimum for our five-year annualized rate of return, it even sets a more clear definition of how low that our rates can go to. So I think that actually protects the bottom line even more.
Okay. Thank you. Any Senator Bundy?
Yeah, thank you. You listed a list of organizations you might use to establish a minimum interest rate. Is this a flexible group, or do you have a particular group that you would use to set the minimum interest rate, or do you require that this change from year to year?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, that's an excellent question. The way the bill reads that we could set it by regulation, and what we would do is look at each rate and put out in regulation our proposal. I'm sure we'll get back comments from the banks and the financial institutions that use this. And right now, I would believe they would probably want to use the Federal Home Loan Bank, which is the bank that our banks locally borrow from when they don't want to go to the Federal Reserve Board window. So it's a rate that they use already. And it's a rate that's favorable to borrowers, but isn't so low that we can't make money. So even though we have the ability to look at other rates, I would suspect that's the rate we would use.
Okay. And another question of mine. On page 3, starting on line 25 or 26, I've noticed you've removed the section where it prohibited someone from receiving an additional loan until the original loan had been repaid, and I'm just wondering why that.
Yes, Senator Bundy, I believe Kathy Jeans was going to be speaking to sections 4 and 5.
Oh, okay, thank
you. So, in other words, I think.
I'll hold the question.
Yeah, I think we're just about there.
I'm jumping ahead. And
so, I, in my understanding, you two have covered sections 1, 2, and 3, and then Ms. Jeans is going to come up and do sections 4 and 5.
But it's, right. it's an excellent question.
And I admire your good judgment.
Yeah. To the chair, the way the RDIF fund works is that originally ADA funded that fund, and it is under our program or our financial statements, but it is run by the Division of Investments, and pretty much they've controlled that fund over the history of the fund.
Correct. It's devolved in a revolving fund, even though we originally funded it, which is excellent. Revolving funds don't need general fund, and they become self-sustaining, hopefully, if they're well managed. So,
thank you. No further questions. We thank you, Mr. Leonard and Mr. Davis, very much for very
thank
succinct
very
testimony. So we would call Kathy Jeans. Please state your name and affiliation, and let us know what we need to know about sections 4 and 5.
Okay. Hi, my name is Kathy Jeans. I'm the Systems Branch Manager for the Division of Investments.
Thank you.
Our agency administers a number of state loan programs, including the Rural Development Initiative Fund. That would be amended by sections 4 and 5. Some quick background on our program. The Rural Development Initiative Fund program was established in 2000 to provide loans to small businesses, creating jobs in rural communities around the state. The program is based on a very similar program that was operated for many years by the former Department of Community and Regional Affairs. We administer the program for ADA, and the portfolio currently consists of about 40 loans, totaling about $4.1 million in debt. The program is set up as a revolving loan fund, which means all repayments and earnings that come back into the fund are retained in the fund, and all operating expenses are then paid out of the fund. We currently have about $1.5 million that's available to lend. The changes proposed in this bill come about as a result of input from the public, as well as internal discussions that focused on improvements that could be made to this program. So Section 4 removes the restriction that a borrower can only have one loan at a time and increases the dollar amount that's allowed under the program from $100,000 per person to $150,000 per individual, and from $200,000 to $300,000 for two or more persons. Section 5 allows us to reduce the minimum interest rate that can be charged from 6% to 4%. So we do support the changes because we believe this will increase utilization of the program, increasing jobs and benefits of economic conditions to our rural communities. So we submitted zero fiscal notes. There's no administrative cost to us to oversee the changes. So this will conclude my testimony, Mr. Chairman, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much, Ms. Jeans. Senator Bundy has said.
And my question, and of course, after the all the toxic mortgage debacle, I'm just wondering why allow them to have more than one loan, and is there a possibility that we would get people in over their head that way.
Back when the program, through the chair to Senator Bundy, back when the program first started in 2000, sometimes when you start up a business, they could come in and get a loan, but maybe they paid off their loan after 5 or 6 years, and they wanted to come back and give them get another loan with us, and they couldn't. So we thought by removing the number of loans that you could have at one time, that and increasing the dollar amount, that things cost a lot more these days. So we thought that would give them more opportunity to expand and start up their business.
Maybe I'm having difficulty understanding. I understand increasing the dollar amount. That makes sense. But you said they paid off a loan and they'd come back and have asked for another and couldn't get it. But this subsection clearly said you can't have another until you've paid it off. And so if they've already paid off a loan, why couldn't they have another?
Through the chair, my apologies, Senator Bundy. I'm maybe a little nervous. They can get a loan and pay it off and come back and get another. But when they have a loan with us, then at that time they cannot get another loan under the current statute. Yeah. My apologies.
And my concern was, you've got one, and you know they're starting to pyramiding and get underwater by with another loan. What is your process for judging? Someone has a loan, they come in and they ask for a second loan. What is the due diligence there so that they're not tying up money that they won't be able to repay?
So through the chair to Senator Bundy, we do look at the loss and credit risk. If they were to fill out another application, we would evaluate that particular borrower to make sure that we weren't going to put them to where they couldn't even make their first loan payment with us or put them into a delinquency status. And that we'd also look at how much maybe capital they're putting into the project also, and look at their, their financial statements and other types of records. And
okay, I just wanted on the record that they intend to do the diligence so we don't end up with people underwater.
Thank you, Mr. Leonard. Were you signaling that you wanted to and certainly if you'd like to add something, you're more than welcome to if necessary. I'm just
right. If Senator Bundy, through the chair, Senator Bundy, if he's okay with it, all I would add is that one of the reasons when I talked to should I come back up?
Thanks.
And please identify yourself.
For the record, I'm Ted Leonard with ADA. All I was going to say when we were originally discussing this with the Division of Investments, it was a challenge sometimes. My understanding is that when a business, especially a startup business, for example, should they come to Division of Investments when they start or a couple years down? So if they had the first loan, which was, say, $50,000 to start up, then they were stuck for that 5 years. And even if they were being very successful in expanding, they couldn't come back to this program. So they're trying to set a limit of, $150,000 to increase. But if a business had good credit and was expanding, this would give them the flexibility to increase their investment in their business and keep moving forward. And that was the idea behind it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Leonard. Any further questions of Ms. Jeans? Seeing none, we thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Is there anyone else here present that would wish to speak to Senate Bill 300? Seeing none, is there anyone off-site? Seeing none, we will close testimony on Senate Bill 300. What discussion is appropriate for the committee? Seems Senator Bundy.
Yeah, it's either really good news that there's no pushback from anyone, or people are uninformed. I'm not sure which it is. So I would I wish we'd heard something from the banking community that would have offered their opinion on this. But where does the bill go after this? Finance.
Finance.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure they'll have an opportunity then to to hear from the banking community.
Yeah, I believe that there are letters of support, for example, in your packet from KeyBank, yeah. Wells Fargo, First National Bank, Alaska, Alaska USA, Federal Credit, Alaska Bankers Association, Alaska Pacific Bank. So, you know, we do have Mount McKinley Bank, you yeah. know, so I
always like to get those things on the record. So, all right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you, Senator Bundy. Any further discussion? You know, I would be...
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the bill if you so desire.
Please.
I move to report Senate Bill 300 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Any objections? Seeing none, Senate Bill 300 is moved from Senate Labor and Commerce to the next committee of referral. We'll take a brief at ease for signing. We'll bring Senate Labor and Commerce back to order. Again, we have to be out of here by 3:20. There's another committee meeting, and we are kind of behind schedule, as everyone knows. So we are now addressing Senate Bill 292, and we welcome to the committee. Hold on, let me get my notes here. So Mr. Temple from Senator Huggins' office, would you please, Mr. Temple, present to us the merits of Senate Bill 292.
Mr. Chairman, unfortunately, Senator Huggins couldn't be here today, but I will be presenting the bill. CS, this is actually a blank CS for Senate Bill 292, if that would be okay to address.
Okay. Do I have the CS?
Oops. I don't see the CS.
It's there. It's behind the bill.
Yes, if there is no objection, I'd like to bring the committee substitute for Senate Bill 292 and its version S before the committee.
Yeah. But do we have a copy of that?
Yes, we do. It's towards the back, I think, just before your third tab.
It's after the fiscal notes.
So we...
Okay, yeah.
We all have backslash yeah. S in front of us.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I move that we use... CS for Senate Bill 292 / S as our working document.
Okay.
Yes. No objections. We now have / S before Senate Labor and Commerce. So, Mr. Temple, the floor is yours.
CS for SB 292, an act relating to the registration and operation of pawnbrokers, to the exemption for pawnbrokers under the Alaska Small Loans Act, and to the exclusion of pawnbrokers under certain definitions in the Uniform Commercial Code, and providing for an effective date. Currently in the Alaska statute, there are only a few paragraphs dealing with pawnbrokers. What's happening right now is that from city to city and borough to borough, pawnbroker regulation varies. Frequently, there is no regulation. By passing this bill, we'll be creating an even standard across Alaska. This bill will protect consumers. It will protect businesses in Alaska. This effort started 4 years ago. Josh Appleby was actually a staffer who started working on this 4 years ago. And seen a lot of eyes and had a lot of input during that time, and I think at least a couple of you on this committee have seen this bill in past years. But where this is right now is it basically codifies what good pawn shops are currently doing. And later we'll hear from some pawn shops, some good pawn shops that support this. I'm sure everyone here knows how pawn shops work. You need money, you have an item of value, you go into a pawn shop and use it as collateral to get a loan. And once you get some more money from somewhere else, you come back into the pawn shop, you pay off your loan as well as a little bit of interest, and get your item of value back. Well, that will now fall under the licensing of the Department of Community and Economic Development. In this bill, we've put some restrictions on who pawnbrokers can work with. Anyone that comes into a pawn shop to pawn an item has to be 18 or over. They have to be sober. They have to have a valid form of ID, and they can't be pawning stolen items. The pawnbroker has to keep a record or a log, and it can be either a written record or a record on a computer. And they have to keep that record for 1 year. Pawnbrokers, when they make a transaction, they have to give a receipt called a transaction agreement to the person who's coming in to pawn an item. This bill includes restrictions on interest and fees. This bill requires pawnbrokers to safely store any item that you're coming in using collateral. This bill offers guidelines for people who come in and aren't able to pay for their item in the appropriate amount of time, including a 30-day grace periods in here. If a service member comes into a pawn shop, pawns an item, and gets deployed, that item and any interest in that item is frozen in the pawn shop until the service member returns from deployment and then goes back to wherever the original agreement was. This bill limits the employees that can be hired in a pawn shop. If within 5 years an employee has a or someone has a felony or they have a misdemeanor dealing with dishonesty, they can't be hired in the pawn shop. This offers guidelines for stolen property that appears in the pawn shops. It offers guidelines to both police and to the property owners that find their property in pawn shop. This requires pawn shops to give weekly inventory reporting to local law enforcement agencies. This also allows for the department to discipline pawnbrokers who end up going against these regulations. Now, the thing to remember with all of what I just said, though, is that good pawn shops are currently doing all of this. This will not affect good pawn shops. And by passing this bill, we're eliminating a lot of confusion. We're offering protection from the unethical few that will always be out there. And we're protecting consumers, as well as businesses in Alaska. That's all I have. I'd be happy to take questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Temple. Senator Bundy.
The 1 year limitation, is that after redemption or is that total time from the time something's pawned? You keep the record for 1 year, because I assume most items are redeemed in less than a year. But.
Through the chair, that's correct. That's just they have to keep the record and maintained well for 1 year so that record's there in case the police need to come back and check for stolen property or
and
something like that.
At the date the item was pawned.
Through the chair, that's correct.
Okay.
Senator.
Any further questions? Seeing none, we thank Mr. Temple, and I do believe that the public in general, I think it serves all our interest to know that there are some statutes out there where people are trying to set minimum standards for pawn shops. So we do have a number of people that are prepared to testify that are they off-site? I think so. Yes.
One more. Question for Josh, if I could.
Yes, Senator Bundy.
Somebody had mentioned to me, dealing vernacular you and I would be familiar with, someone has a $1,000, $1,200 rifle, wants to get a $500 loan on that, but he really needs $800 or $900. So he can only get five on the rifle. If he needs to get the rest of the money, he has to bring in a second rifle to get the rest of the money. And so he really has two items of value tied up to get the $800 or $900. Was there discussion of raising the $500 maximum when you developed the bill?
Through the chair, that's correct. There has been discussion. The pawnbrokers we've been working with, I think you'll hear two different sides of where that limit should be. We've kept it at $500, which is a limit that you're talking about. It's been the one on the books for quite a while. And the independent pawnbrokers, small businesses, have agreed that the best thing for them is to keep that limit at $500. I know they're still in discussions with some of the bigger pawnbrokers as to whether they could possibly afford to raise that limit, but that's we're waiting to hear from them as to what comes out of that.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I would just point out this previous bill, they went from increased the amount of loans available in ADA because the world has changed and things cost more. And I would encourage the sponsor to look at that number as this bill goes through the process. It may be too late to discuss it now, but thought came to mind. As long as you're revamping, yeah, look at the whole thing. All right, thank you.
All right, thank you, Senator Bundy. We go to Noel Lowe.
Yeah, I'm here. This is Noel.
All right, please state your name, affiliation, and because we are in such a short time limit, I would ask you to be very precise and let's get going.
My name is Noel Lowe. I own Alaska Fast Cash in Wasilla. I'm here also with John Minnick, who owns A1 Pawn Shop in Wasilla as well. We're not here really to provide any statement on the bill other than that we've worked with Senator Huggins' office to craft the legislation. We're in support of the legislation before you. We have talked with other pawn shops about potentially raising the amount of the loan, and the general consensus was we don't feel that it's broken, but we would be amenable to a raise to $750 from $500. And other than that, we primarily wanted to be available today to answer questions, if there are any.
Thank you. If we could, thank you, Noel. If John Minnick.
Yes, I'm right here, too.
So, yeah, please state your name, affiliation, and if I understand that you do support it, it's sufficient if you just say you support, and that's enough.
Yes, my name is John Minnick. I own A1 Pawn Shop in Wasilla. And like Noel just stated, we are in full support of this bill.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Minnick. Fernando Pena, are you available? Fernando Pena, Pena, P-E-N-A?
That's correct. Fernando Pena with Cash America.
All right, and please provide your testimony. And again, if you're in support, you know, I understand everyone that's calling in is in support, but if there's anything in particular that you haven't heard someone previously speak to, you're certainly welcome to provide that to us.
Thank you, sir. I will try to be brief. I did have some prepared remarks, but in the interest of time, I will be brief. Thank you, Chairman Passman and members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee for the opportunity to speak to you today on, in support of Senate Bill 292. Again, my name is Fernando Pena. I am the Government Affairs Director for Cash America. We operate five pawn shops in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm pleased to be speaking in support of this bill. While this year's proposal has undergone some revisions, I just wanted to remind you that it had originally been proposed in the House in 2008. And I'm happy to see that the spirit and intent of the prior proposal has been retained in the current version. So I'm glad to speak up again in support of this bill. It's my hope that the committee will take a real hard look at the needed provisions of the bill and provide for a speedy passage so that your constituents will finally have the consumer and business operator protections, standardization, and regulatory framework that they rightfully deserve. Just to add quickly, provide a bit of background on the need for the bill. Alaska, as has been mentioned, is the only state in the nation without comprehensive regulation of pawn shops. And this bill really addresses that oversight and provides the needed consumer and business operator protections that Mr. Temple had mentioned earlier. In researching the issue, it was apparent to us that we're not really trying to fix a problem that exists currently, but what's important is that we are trying to be proactive since current pawn shop owners and their customers are vulnerable to unforeseen circumstances that could affect the industry. This proactive approach will protect both the consumer and the operator by instituting a regulatory framework under which we can operate statewide so that a customer will know what to expect, for example, during a pawn transaction, be it taking place in Anchorage, Wasilla, or Fairbanks. And really, this bill marries the best of current regulation among the lower 48 states, and pawn shops will be regulated by the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, and will establish a transparent operating structure for pawnbrokers so that customers will know what to expect in any statewide shop. And it will hold the pawnbrokers to a higher standard by strengthening our relationship, which is already very strong among police agencies across the state. And it will also provide for due process for misappropriated property for all parties involved. And, this bill also honors our service members who have risked so much to defend our cherished freedoms with the opportunity of not having to be concerned about any property that's in a pawn shop while deployed overseas. In conclusion, I'd like to just take a quick opportunity to thank Senator Huggins for his efforts to support the pawn shop operators in the state and the consumers. Chairman Pasta and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today. I'm respectfully requesting your support of Senate Bill 292, and I would be happy to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pena. There are no questions. And the final witness that I believe that we have to call is Alex Vaughn, also of Cash America.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, state
your
name.
I was just going to be available for questions if the committee had some.
All right. I take it you are in support of this bill?
Yes, sir. I do support the bill.
Yeah, so if you could just state your name, affiliation, and just indicate that, and that would be sufficient.
Yes, sir. My name is Alex Vaughn, Vice President of Government Affairs, Cash America International, and I do support the passage of Senate Bill 292.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Vaughn. There are no questions of the committee. Are there any other individuals off net that that's all the people that have signed up off net? Is there anyone physically present here? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony on Senate Bill 292. Senator Bundy.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move from committee Senate Bill 292 with individual recommendations attached to fiscal notes.
The committee substitute for
CS, thank you.
Is there any objection? Senate Bill 292, as the committee substitute /S, is moved from Senate Labor and Commerce to the next committee of referral. We'll take a brief at ease for signing.
bring Senate Labor and Commerce back to order. We now have before us Senate Bill 304, which is a Model Entities Transaction Act. We have Mr. Mike Garrity online, and I think that it's I do not intend upon presenting this to the committee today, and the purpose of this is to begin the discussion on what a Model Entities Transaction Act is and what it is hopefully intended upon accomplishing. So, Mr. Garrity, if you could please state your name and affiliation, and we welcome you to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Am I being heard clearly?
Yes, sir.
Yes, my name is Mike Garrity. I'm an attorney in private practice in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm also a Uniform Law Commissioner for the state of Alaska. The Uniform Law Commission, for those of you who aren't familiar, is a body that was formed over 100 years ago with the general goal of trying to develop uniform laws for consideration and enactment by the various states. As a republic of 50 states, it's not difficult to imagine the mayhem and havoc that could be wreaked if businesses or individuals had to cope with radically different laws as they cross state lines. And so the goal of the Uniform Law Commission has been to draft and enact these types of laws to, in particular, enhance commerce and economic development. And in 1914, the Uniform Law Commission first enacted a Uniform Partnership Act. So, as I said, it goes back very, very far. Today, there are partnerships, limited liability partnerships, limited liability companies, and corporations that are entities that we're all generally familiar with. And they form the basic entities under American law that provide the means to aggregate capital, limit liability where applicable, and they also provide a structure to organize and govern an enterprise, and whether it be for profit or non-profit. Most of this work has been done by the Uniform Law Commission in collaboration with the American Bar Association, but it's the development of these model acts and uniform acts for these various entities has made America law particularly efficient for entrepreneurs. Anyone who establishes and develops a business has choices available for the entity, and they can choose the entity form that is going to best benefit their business. As a business grows, these options also allow for some changes in form to the business. For example, a small enterprise may choose to be a partnership initially, but once it grows, it has the opportunity to reorganize as a corporation when the business is big enough to warrant the advantages of the corporate form. And I would emphasize this is also true for nonprofit businesses. Today, there is a great array of these same organizational forms that can be used for nonprofit businesses such as limited liability companies and limited partnerships. So it's also very important for the nonprofit world. This flexibility and the development of these business entities has really made America law the envy of the rest of the world, for this reason, that there are so many options and there's a well-developed body of law regarding these various entities. But this Model Entity Transactions Act, or META as it's been called, is a significant development in the growth of these various entities. Today, there is no real comprehensive statutory framework for changing entity form, whether it's for merger of entities, conversion of one entity to another, what they call exchange of interests, or if you wanted to change the location of an entity, which is also called a domestication. Within some of the more recent model acts, for instance, the Model Corporations Code, there's provisions dealing with mergers of corporations, for example, and there's some statutory framework for the merger of like-kind entities, partnerships with partnerships, corporations with corporations, and so on. But what this particular act does, SB 304, allows for the conversion of one entity to another, and it does it all in this one statutory framework. The problem with mergers and conversions and changing the location of entities, for example, if that's what you want to do, is that many times it involves having to dissolve one entity to accomplish the desired end. You would have to technically wind down a business, possibly satisfying creditors and interest holders in the winding down, and potentially incurring adverse tax consequences in the process of forming a new business. This is a burden when the object is not to dissolve the business, but to simply continue it in another form or another location. As you might imagine, the hazards of this process are many and they're costly. A statute that allows these events to occur without dissolving at least one of the entities involved certainly will increase efficiency and lower costs for our entrepreneurs and for business in general. A general statute, which is not limited to corporations or not limited to partnerships, is highly desirable to accomplish this goal and to allow what they call cross-entity transactions. And again, that's what SB 304 is intended to accomplish and what it does accomplish, and I commend the chairman and the committee for bringing this act, this bill forward. There's basically, within SB 304, there's four types of transactions which are addressed. There's a merger, which we can all familiar with. It's one entity with another entity. There's a conversion, which is changing one entity to another type of entity, for example, a partnership to a corporation. There's what's called an interest exchange, which would be, for example, all the holders of units in a limited partnership, for example, exchange all the units in that limited partnership for shares in a corporation, for example. And the final one is what's called, as they refer to, a domestication. For example, a businessman owns a business in California, moves with his family to Alaska, and let's say he has a business in California and doesn't want to end it or quit it, but he finds that maybe it would be more advantageous for him to have it registered as an Alaska corporation than have it formed as an Alaska corporation. And so he wants to change the location of the corporation. That's called a domestication. It's an entity that's originally organized in one state, and you're going to change it into an entity in your state. And so that's the fourth major type of conversion, if you will, or type of transaction that's addressed in SB 304. In each one of these transactions, there has to be a plan that's approved by the interest holders in these various entities. That would be shareholders. It could be debt holders, for example. Because one of the goals here is to make sure that no interest is extinguished in the process of any of these transactions under SB 304, whether it's a merger, a conversion, an interest exchange, or a domestication. For example, if you had someone who was a creditor of a partnership, if that partnership for legitimate reasons decides it's better to do business as a corporation and it were to convert to a corporation under this bill, the bill is very careful to preserve that debt and to preserve that interest, and so that the bill cannot be used to circumvent obligations, to escape obligations, to evade obligations, and the same is true for shareholders and the like. Unless the corporation, if you wanted to, or the owners of a partnership, for example, the bill does not run afoul of whatever agreement the partners may have or shareholders may have. It follows whatever, if it requires two-thirds of a vote of the partners to affect something, that is honored. There's no provision in there then all the partners would have to agree to the conversion under the bill. So it's very careful in protecting the rights of dissenters, if you will. It's very careful in protecting the rights of interest holders, so that nobody, cross-entity transactions, these conversions and so on that we're talking about, do not prejudice or harm those legitimate interests. And so that's also an important part of the bill. Overall, the purpose of the bill is to set up some procedures that end up with an entity that continues the business of the previous entities that it succeeds without extinguishing obligations, and it does it in a seamless and non-disruptive transfer, and it does it without having to dissolve one of the businesses, for example, in order to accomplish the conversion. It's good for business and nonprofit ventures alike, and as I said, I commend the chairman and the committee for bringing this bill forward. It does involve, as you said, there's each one of these transactions involves a plan that has to be approved by everyone, and it involves various disclosure requirements that need to be filed with the Department of Commerce and Economic Development. The plan itself, once the plan is approved or takes place, there has to be a permanent record, so that so that there are some record keeping requirements, filing requirements and the like that need to be observed, and so that it's all open and transparent. In conclusion, I just want to point out that there's three issues I think that merit the committee's consideration and the chairman's consideration. But one is, as I mentioned, Alaska has on its books already and has for some time, entity, we have a Uniform Partnership Act, we have a Limited Liability Company Act, we have a Corporations Code and so on. Some of these existing statutory schemes already provide for mergers and the like. Typically, though, just like-kind transactions, corporation, merge with a corporation and so on, or a partnership with a partnership. So what's different about this is not only does it address those types of transactions, but as I said, SB 304 also addresses, more importantly, cross-entity transactions. So it is important that the bill, which is quite dense, it's a complex piece of legislation, be coordinated carefully with the existing statutory frameworks that exist. There's various ways that that it might be approached, but it's just you got to be careful that the schemes mesh and that there's no inconsistencies and that there's not two ways of merging a corporation, for example. So that requires some attention. That may have already been done. Mr. Chairman, I can't speak as it's a complex bill, but that may have already been done in the drafting process. I don't know that, but I just say that would be something that would merit some study and consideration.
All right, Mr. Garrity, just we have a time commitment, and I really do thank you for your patience. We had a kind of a difficult start today because we were conflicted with another committee, but you have gotten Senate Bill 304 off to a wonderful start, and I know that we've been, Mr. Branch is here today. I spoke with him yesterday. Lynn is here, and some of these very issues that you're raising have been discussed, and we very much sincerely appreciate your getting Senate Bill 304, the Model Entities Transaction Act, off the ground, so to speak, and look forward to your ongoing participation. And again, all the committee members do thank you for getting this off and running.
Thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chairman.
All right, thank you. And with that, Senate Labor and Commerce is adjourned for this Thursday, March 18th.